Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. Among its very important battle spaces, of course, is Asia. And there are a few people who cover it more assiduously and thoughtfully and helpfully than our first guest. He is Gordon Chang, a regular here at Secure Freedom Radio. You also find him at Fox News, frequently contributing at the Daily Beast and elsewhere. He is the author of two important books, The Coming Collapse of China and Nuclear Showdown North Korea Takes on the World. Gordon, it's so good to have you back. Boy, there do seem to be a number of things that you've been predicting for some time coming to pass. Let's start with North Korea. The Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo, of course, was in East Asia addressing colleagues and counterparts there in the context of the Association of Southeast Asian Nations, reaffirming America's commitment to the region. There does seem to be, though, growing unease about what's going on with respect to North Korea. Talk a little bit about how that's playing out at the moment.
Secretary Pompeo made an important trip to Southeast Asia, reaffirming commitments, as you pointed out. And before I answer the question, one of the most important things he did was he went to Indonesia, which is an important friend. And I think that it's great that we're paying attention to Jakarta. During this trip, Pompeo sounded the warning on North Korea that they're not moving as fast as he had hoped. And that's important because clearly the North Koreans are doing things which are very deeply troubling, including continuing to produce missiles and, of course, ramping up their production of fissile material. They are doing some good things. They did partially dismantle their satellite launching site at Sohae. Of course, they returned 55 sets of remains. But there's so much more work to do, not only on the POW-MIA issues, but also, of course, on dismantling their weapons program. At this particular time, the one very troubling development, and Secretary Pompeo, I think his trip actually tried to address this, is the sanctions regime is not working very well. We're now seeing even South Korea violate the sanctions by buying North Korean coal via Russian ships. President Trump needs to look at all of this, not only South Korea and North Korea, but of course, China and Russia.
Yeah, Gordon, you've been warning for some time about the unreliability of South Korean President Moon. There does seem to be even more ominous things afoot, including dismantling some of South Korea's defenses along the demilitarized zone. At the very best, this seems premature, to say the least, and at worst, it could be a further incentive to the North Koreans to behave in their usual manner, does it not? Talk a little bit about what's going on in Seoul at the moment.
Moon certainly is moving very fast to undermine American interests and the American campaign to denuclearize the North Koreans. You mentioned the guard posts, and there have been discussions with the North Koreans about what they can do to reduce tensions at the demilitarized zone. Really troubling are proposals in South Korea to disband 6 out of 11 divisions, including 2 frontline ones. Moon has been, in effect, campaigning against the military with some reorganizations and also a number of moves to, I think, weaken the defenses there. This is part of his long-term plan, and the United States needs to start speaking out on it. We, of course, have been hesitant to do so, but nonetheless, this is accelerating, and I think that this is going to become extremely troubling. As you know, you have a couple developments here. One of them, there are no more large-scale joint exercises. I think that's given a signal to Moon, basically, to do what he wants to do. So although it was a goodwill gesture on the part of President Trump not to hold these large-scale exercises, I think that they are having a great effect on the South Korean left, and that was not anticipated, I'm sure, by the president.
Yeah, and it certainly is not desirable. Gordon, of course, we can't talk about North Korea and what it's up to without at least a reference to China and its unhelpfulness, shall we say. There has been, of course, not only conduct that is unhelpful, like easing sanctions on the Chinese side of the North Korean border as well. But I wanted to ask you about some other things that are going on in China that may portend very far-reaching developments, notably that the Chinese economy seems to be coming unglued a bit. The Chinese seem to be becoming more belligerent towards President Trump. Give us a read on what you think is happening within China at the moment and its implications for the rest of us.
There's anxiety in Beijing right now among the elites. There's a number of things going on. One of them is, first of all, you have a new assertiveness on the part of the Chinese population. There were protests over adulterated vaccines. Now you have protests in Beijing over the failure of various companies, or in the case of HNA, the large conglomerate, the failure to pay back investors. But also there is concern about the general direction of the economy. You have China's stock indices are among the world's worst performing. And you have the currency falling very, very rapidly. The Chinese government is trying to slow the descent, but at this particular time, it's not having too much of an effect. And you have a stagnant economy. You have very assertive elites who are now questioning Xi Jinping. Most people say Xi Jinping's position in the political system is secure, but if another few bad months, I think that you could see turmoil at the top of the Chinese political system. I don't think you can take very much for granted right now. And the thing you got to be concerned about is that the Chinese political system, in response, will lash out, just like we saw a few hours ago where Chinese media, which had really been very sort of muted in terms of the trade war when it came to President Trump personally, has now lashed out at him. And that's an indication that they're starting to lose their cool in Beijing, and not just on trade, not just on President Trump, but I think we're going to see them lose their cool across the board. When they do that, they could do something really awful, like put even more pressure on Taiwan, with perhaps even military action against the island.
I've been wondering if that's on your mind, as it is mine, Gordon Chang. This is something that I think all of us anticipate is coming in the not-too-distant future, but the widespread expectation was China was going to continue building up its military capabilities to be able decisively to act against the Taiwan military and people, and that we had a bit more time to go. But it sounds from what you've said as though things may be accelerating. You will be watching that closely, I know, at the Daily Beast and Fox News and elsewhere, as well as from time to time joining us. And I look forward to hearing more about that subject, as well as all of the other incredibly important issues in your portfolio. Gordon Chang, thank you for your time today. As always, we'll look forward to talking with you next week. Next up, Matt Brodsky joins us. We'll talk with him about developments in Iran and Turkey and more right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. It's a pleasure to say we are joined once again by Matt Brodsky. He is an independent research analyst with great expertise on matters involving national security in general, but particularly the Middle East. He was one of the contributing authors to a product out of the Foundation for Defense of Democracies entitled Controlled Chaos, talking about Israel, Iran, and Syria, in which there is some chaos for sure. It remains to be seen how long it'll be controlled. He formerly served as the director of policy for the Jewish Policy Center. He is also a very frequent contributor to our program, for which we're very grateful. Matt, it's Good to have you back. Welcome.
Pleasure to be with you.
So a lot of things going on in one of the contributors to that controlled chaos, as you call it, Iran. I'd like to talk with you, first of all, in the wake of the sanctions that President Trump reimposed yesterday, marking the end of the Obama legacy vis-a-vis Iran, hopefully, being met, or at least accompanied by, intensifying protests on the ground in Iran at the moment, and a lot of evidence that the source of the unhappiness of those protesters is the regime itself and what it's been doing with their money. Talk a bit about what's happening in Iran and what you think is likely to come of these new sanctions the president has imposed.
Well, these are waves of protests that have been spreading throughout Iran for 7 to 8 months now. So they have been quite durable. They've cut across the different social strata. And that's important because it's a distinction between this type of protest movement and the ones they've had in the past. The recent ones were in Isfahan and Shahin, Sahar, and Najaf Abad. These are all in the Isfahan province, which typically are assumed to have been on the government side. So that's very significant. Usually these stem from economic issues, lack of water. However, they're taking to saying now death to the dictator, death to Rouhani, and a lot of other chants are bringing up the fact that Iran is spending billions of dollars with its adventurism, talking about in Syria, in Yemen, in Gaza, money that the people think should be spent for the good of the Iranian people as opposed to foreign adventurism. And this is a very important distinction. We have to remember that about 16 billion a year is the budget Iran is spending to prop up Assad. That's aside from 8.2 billion a year for the IRGC annual budget. It's significant money.
And money for Hezbollah, lest we forget their proxies there, and Hamas in Gaza. I mean, these are real dollars we're talking about for a country that is struggling on a good day. And we've seen the plummeting value of their currency. Matt, do you think that the sanctions will have the effect of propelling further the seeming growing appetite for regime change in Iran?
Yeah, I think that's the important metric. I think they will have a very determinative effect, especially since, I mean, this is going to make a horrible economy even worse. And the people know that the reason for this is because of the regime. It's not being blamed on the West. In fact, the chants against the West have pretty much become passé at this point. The people know the jig is up. They can tell that the administration or that their government is basically messing with them and spoiling their own future. So I don't think attempts to point elsewhere is going to really quell anything with the movement here.
Yeah, well, I hope our own government will be helping them along to the extent we can. And Matt, you mentioned Iran and Syria in the same breath there. There was a potentially quite important development over the weekend as a prominent Syrian scientist was assassinated. Tell us a bit about him and what it means that he's been taken out.
This is Dr. Aziz Asbar, and he is the head scientist at the Syrian Scientific Studies and Research Center, one of the three main locations inside of Syria that works on chemical weapons. It's been tied to North Korea and Iran very specifically. He is the head of not only that department, but in charge of long-range missile procurement and development. So he has been very high on the list for Israel for a while. We believe that he was killed by Israel, though Israel is not taking responsibility. It happened through a car bomb. Israel has had first of all, they've been striking this site repeatedly over the past few years. The Revolutionary Guards are known to have a camp nearby.
Oh, so the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps.
Correct. Yes. The IRGC is essentially camped out there. So he has been working with the research and development facility there. The car bomb fits a pattern. Israel had killed the Hezbollah mastermind of the 1984 U.S. Marine barracks bombing in Beirut. They did that in Damascus in 2008. They also, at that point, killed Mohammed Suleiman, who was the Syrian general who was in charge of a shadow army that made the nuclear program work and was in charge of chemical weapons previously. So this fits a pattern of what Israel would likely do. And it's designed to send another message to both Moscow and to Damascus that it's not going to deal with Iran entrenchment inside of Syria, and that they're very serious about it. So it's a much more major development than I think the news is giving it.
Yeah, well, I appreciate you spending some time walking us through it, because I think you're right, especially if this character was intimately involved in not just the Syrian ballistic missile program, but also what could go on the front end of it, notably chemical or biological weapons, perhaps nuclear if things got going again there. This is an important prophylactic, shall we say, measure, presumably by the Israelis. Let me turn to one of the other things that you've been thinking about and writing on, Matt Brodsky. You had a piece recently entitled America's Turkey Problem Finally Comes to a Head. This, I think, is in the first instance about an American pastor. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo just reaffirmed the determination of the president and the Trump administration to extricate Andrew Brunson and others being held hostage by the Turks, American citizens. Tell us a little bit about what else is going on here in terms of the problem that we have with Turkey and what the administration may be intent on doing about those as well.
Well, aside from the problem with the pastor is the fact that Turkey is receiving the F-35 Lightning, which is basically the United States' top-of-the-line multi-role fighter plane, and also has stealth capabilities. At the same time, instead of purchasing the Patriot missile defense, aircraft defense system, they've turned to Russia to buy the S-400, which is Russia's world-class air defense system. So they would like to have both at the same time, which under no circumstance should we allow, given Turkey's behavior. The problem is the S-400 can pick up a lot of information from the F-35, especially if they're operated by the same government. That information could, of course, then be passed on to Russia and other of America's enemies. And one of those enemies is, of course, Iran and Syria, who Iran has the S-300 so far from Russia guarding its nuclear sites. And Russia, of course, has brought in its own S-400. So it's not just a problem in theory. This gets back to what Israel is doing inside of Syria. It's not just that they killed the scientist in Syria, but they have a red line for game-changing weapons such as the S-300 and other advanced weapon systems being transferred into Syria. And in one of the three times that Israel over the past year has targeted the T4 airbase deep inside Syria, it was transferring a Khordad, which is basically a S-300 version, an Iranian version of the S-300, and they destroyed that along with some IRGC members. So this would really change the rules of the game inside of Syria and could put the entire F-35 fleet at risk, because of course Israel flies the F-35 right now.
Right. So, Matt, there's a lot to talk about here with respect to Turkey, but just to stay with the F-35 for a moment, is it your recommendation that the F-35 fighter aircraft that Turkey has ordered from us not be delivered to Turkey?
There's no way that the F-35 should be delivered under any circumstance right now with Turkey currently as it is. And there should be additional penalties for the S-400 purchase. Again, that weapon, so the S-400 doesn't integrate with any of NATO's air defense systems. So it's of no value to anyone in NATO and is just about harm. There are other things the U.S. could do, of course. The U.S. could get cute, still send the F-35, but deny doing updates to the cloud-based logistics information system that it has, which would basically make the fighter jet fairly useless. So there are things the U.S. can do. But to start with, it should just simply not receive the top-of-the-line U.S. jet separately, and it separately should not be allowed to get the Russian S-400 without facing severe penalties.
Yeah. I'm just wondering, Matt, if you could sort of back the lens up a little bit. This incident with the pastor, these activities with respect to these weapon systems are fitting now a pattern of increasingly brazen hostility on the part of the Turks towards the United States and their NATO allies. Are they not?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, we're talking about a dictator who last year dispatched his security guards to beat up peaceful protesters in Washington, D.C. while he watched from his limo. He's also been supporting the Muslim Brotherhood throughout the region.
Matt Brodsky, there's so much more to talk about, but we're going to have to do it on another occasion. I appreciate you joining us today, and I hope you'll come back to us again very soon. Next up, we will speak with Dakota Wood. Straight ahead.
More with Frank Gaffney.
We're back. I'm very pleased to say we are joined by Dakota Wood. He is a retired lieutenant colonel in the United States Marine Corps, in which he served with great distinction, including doing important work planning and executing Operations Enduring and Iraqi Freedom. He has been working for some time now in the think tank world, notably with the Heritage Foundation, where we find him these days. He is a senior research fellow at its Center for National Defense. Always a valued contributor to this program, and we're hoping to hear a lot more from him in the days ahead. But for today, Dakota Wood, it is terrific to have you with us to help us think through the case for rebuilding the U.S. military, the topic of a recent piece you've done. Welcome back.
It's always a great pleasure to be with you. Thanks.
So I think the case is fairly clear to most listeners to this program, at least. But how would you succinctly describe it, Dakota?
Well, I mean, everybody that was running for president a couple of years ago, and certainly many members of Congress, have talked about the aging of the U.S. military, how it has shrunk in size due to budget cuts, among other reasons, and how we're using up the equipment and even people at really accelerated rates because of sustained operations. So there's this big argument for rebuilding it, but that really begs the question of rebuild it to do what? I mean, do you just want newer things of the stuff that you've been using up, or as you look into the future, does the military need to be something different? And how do you account for all of these new technologies, that are coming out of the civilian side, industry, and even the military labs? And so this paper we published was trying to look at that, that yes, we need to rebuild the military. How do you account for a future that hasn't yet occurred because it's, it's downrange? And are there better ways to go about doing that that give you a higher probability of getting something good out of a tax dollar spent, taxpayer dollar spent, as opposed to the normal path, which wastes a lot of money and really doesn't accomplish what designers are intending to accomplish.
Yeah. I'm going to paraphrase rather than say it quite as elegantly as you did, Dakota, but you had a critical point, it seemed to me, in that paper, which is you've got to be thinking about and addressing and working towards generational changes in terms of your military capabilities and kit. But you also got to cover what happens in between the generations.
Well, that's it. I mean, this is the weird thing is people want these kind of revolutionary leap ahead capabilities and thinking about things a generation ahead, exactly what you said. But the problem is they try to envision what the world might be like 20 years from now. They design a requirement. I need a new type of tank or an airplane or a death ray. And then they put all this money into the research and development piece to that to strive to solve the engineering challenges to create this new thing. And what happens almost without variation is the technology proves to be more difficult than planned. It's going to cost 2 to 3 times what was originally estimated. And when you finally roll something out 10 or 15 years later, it takes about 15 years to field a system, it underperforms. It's got less capability than what you'd imagine. Along with that is a desire for greater efficiencies. So if I design one tactical fighter and it has multifunctional capability, then I get a lot of savings out of a less complicated parts inventory. I could train mechanics and pilots, you know, through one pipeline. So I get real efficiencies out of that. The problems with both of those are if I have guessed wrong, or the platform that I've designed has some kind of an operational shortfall or a characteristic that the enemy can exploit, you know, figure out and then work around that, my entire capability or steal, then the entire capability has been compromised. So these are single points of failure. And what we're proposing, what I've written in this paper, is that if you do a lot of experimentation and you incorporate new things along the way, right, on a regular basis, then you're always at the leading edge. You're always figuring out what works and doesn't work ahead of your competitor. And your force is much more nimble. It's much more intellectually agile. It's much more current and more attuned to adapting to changing circumstances than your enemy. And you actually get the revolutionary change in capability on a more consistent basis at much less money and much more effectively on a battlefield.
We're hearing the president talk with regularity about the $700 billion investment that we're now making in our defense rebuilding. We're seeing the new National Defense Authorization Act coming out with still more money for next year. Can you give us hope, Dakota Wood, that there is indeed an effort being made to learn the lessons of the past and avoid some of the mistakes that we have made so as to stretch those tax dollars but get the capabilities and kit that we do need?
Yeah, so I think the good news story is there's recognition that these are problems that need to be solved. The not good news story, the depressing story, is a lack of willingness on the part of Congress to do what it needs to do in terms of appropriately funding things. And by that I mean, at the end of the Cold War, if you remember, you know, back to those days, the United States military was sized and was postured to deal with a global challenge. You know, the Soviets were a lot of places. They had a lot of minions doing things in various regions. And so you had to be a lot of places doing lots of things while attending to alliances and having a sufficient capacity back home to train and get ready for the next rotations. Soviet Union goes away. Over the last 25 plus years, funding has declined while costs have increased. The cost of manpower is more. The type of equipment we buy is higher. And so you have a much smaller military. It's about two-thirds of the size. But the planet is still the same size.
And arguably, the challenges are much bigger.
They've increased. You know, I have to deal with Russia and China and Iran and North Korea. And so you're asking a smaller military to do more things than what it did during the Cold War on less of a budget. So if you even took the 30-year or 40-year average of about 5%, it was oftentimes higher than that of GDP, we've got a national economy of about $18 trillion. So 5% on averages would be about $900 billion. So when we talk today about a $700 billion defense budget, it shows the magnitude that we are underspending relative to historical norms. So we've gotten used to spending little because up through the 90s and even through the early 2000s, we didn't have major competitors. But all these guys have come back now, and we're finding what the consequences are of underinvesting in a military and yet using that military in sustained operations in Iraq and Afghanistan and now in Syria. Where again, you're using things up very, very quickly. So the bright points are people recognize this. The bad point is our national budget is not aligned with the national defense strategy that General Mattis or Secretary of Defense Mattis has published, which I think is a good strategy. We just don't have the military that can execute it.
Let me talk to you about a couple of specific areas of concern, if I could, Dakota. I'll be talking momentarily with Dan Gallington about this idea of a space force. and space warfare more generally, as space as a domain of military activity. I'd like to get your thoughts on that as well, if I could. Where do you come down, Dakota, on the need for having a dedicated service, as the president has proposed, to protect our equities in space and if necessary, to wage war from the high frontier?
So right now, we're critically dependent on space. You just cannot underinvest or ignore that domain. The military realizes how incredibly dependent they are on it, and so they're seeking non-space-based solutions to things like, you know, navigation and surveillance systems and those sorts of things. So they're trying to find alternatives. But while we are involved in space, you either have to go all in or dismiss the notion of a space force. Right now, there are about 60, not 16, but 60, 6-0 agencies that have in some way or other ownership of the space issue, whether it's use or the platforms, the sensors, you know, whatever that might be. The U.S. Air Force only owns 3 of those. So you've got 57 other agencies that have involvement in this. So to carve out of the Air Force on the argument that space issues don't receive sufficient attention, and yet not account for the 57 other non-Air Force entities involved, right? It's just going to be an exercise in futility. So if you're going to go space, you have to go big, and you really have to understand the totality of all of the things involved in both putting things up into orbit and then using the products that come out of space-based capabilities and get somebody in charge of that. So it would have to be fairly large. It's another investment in headquarters and manpower and all the bureaucracy that goes along with that. But if you're going to get your arms around it, it has to have commensurate authorities to be able to deal with that big mixture of all these government federal agencies.
Do we have a good example, Dakota Wood? You've studied these things closely, of an entity that would have both a very important military mission and would pull in beneath it the various civilian agencies that presumably also have pieces of that space enterprise.
We've got a good example and a bad example. The good example would be the U.S. Coast Guard. So the Coast Guard is a great example where they've blended the civilian authorities they have and the military responsibilities and authorities they have into one organization. The bad example would be the Department of Homeland Security, where in the wake of 9/11, you took something like 15 agencies, I can't remember the number, from different major organizations of government and brought them all under one secretary, trying to integrate those things with different retirement plans, different seniority ratings, different areas of responsibility. How do you create a culture, right, that's looking at homeland security in kind of a cohesive way? And I think DHS is still in its growing pains because, you know, it's only been around for 15 years or so.
Dakota, we have to leave it at that. There's so much more to talk with you about. I hope you'll come back to us again very soon for a longer conversation. Next up, Dan Gallington, as promised, right after this.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back. We are joined by Dan Gallington, a man who has served in more capacities in the United States government than you can shake a stick at, including serving as a Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for Territorial Security. He was also a General Counsel for the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence. He had, in previous lives, represented the Secretary of Defense in the nuclear and space talks with the Soviet Union and was a judge advocate general in the Air Force in uniform. He is an old friend and colleague and a great help to this show, now an adjunct professor at the University of Illinois College of Law. Dan Gallington, welcome back. It's so good to have you.
Thanks, Frank. It's always a pleasure.
You have, by virtue of your various previous incarnations, the expertise to help us calibrate what's going on at the moment, Dan, with respect to investigations on Capitol Hill and in the Justice Department concerning this alleged collusion by President Trump's team
with the Russians? This is a big question, and there's a lot to say on it, and I want to talk to you about a bunch of other things. So can you briefly just give us kind of your 30,000-foot assessment of what is going on?
Well, you do recall, Frank, that I was at DOJ for many years in the 90s at what we used to call OIPR, which was the predecessor organization to the National Security Division in DOJ. When I went to the BG, General Counsel for the SSCI, one of the first things we did was ran at that time, a bipartisan investigation into Chinese influence in the 96 presidential election. And it was a bipartisan investigation. I directed it as general counsel. I'm surprised no one has ever mentioned that in the current context, but we found massive amounts of Chinese attempts to influence the 96 election, primarily through cutout contributions of huge amounts of money. So what's happened since 96 is, you know, the SSCI has become politicized.
That's the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence. Right.
Exactly. And they've become politicized. And the investigations, while they're called committee investigations, are typically directed and created and propelled and written by the party who's has the majority. And we saw this most recently when Feinstein's was in charge and did the investigation on enhanced interrogation by the CIA. So I guess that's a long way of answering your question is don't really look for anything except pure politicization of the intel committees when it comes to the issue of Russian influence in the 96 elections.
That's really interesting, Dan, because the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence has been much about the idea that it's running a bipartisan investigation and that the chairman and ranking member are joined at the hip on this. Are you saying that's not in practice how it's working out?
Well, it's the practice now, but when fingers start to point, you can assure yourself in today's political climate that the politics will come out. That's at least my call of the way it is. Do the Russians try to interfere with our elections? Of course they do. And, you know, it's nothing new. The Chinese do it. It's nothing new. It's China. It's the way the Chinese have always operated. So,
well, let me turn to one other thing, Dan, in that regard. You mentioned both the Chinese and their influence operations, as well as Dianne Feinstein, who was been either the ranking member or previously the chairman of the Senate Intelligence Committee for quite some time. It turns out, we're told, based on some rather new reporting about an old revelation, that Dianne Feinstein's driver was for 20 years, evidently, a Chinese communist spy. What do you make of that, Dan? Was that a security problem? And if so, how is it that we're only learning about it now?
Well, first of all, it really demonstrates to the American people, or it should demonstrate, how the Senate's comprised of 100 despots. I don't know how you describe them, 100 kings or whatever. But in their individual role as senators from a particular state, I mean, they have their own fiefdom, and they can run whatever kind of show they want to. And, you know, in the past, we've had Congressman hide money in the freezer, and we've had all kinds of scandals on Capitol Hill. It's nothing new. It's always going to be there. This is a person that's obviously worked his way into the Feinstein senatorial hierarchy and has therefore increased his access to information. I'm sure some of it sensitive or classified.
Well, you just think about driving Dianne Feinstein around, listening at least to her end of a conversation. There would be all kinds of interesting stuff.
Driving Miss Daisy,
indeed. Hey, Dan, let me turn to a different subject you've been also thinking about for a long time and have written presciently about, namely space, the high frontier, as it's been called, as a potential battle domain, and the importance of the United States being both properly equipped and organized to protect its very considerable interests there, and ensure that it's not used against us here on the ground. Talk a little bit about the possibility, as you've written about in the Washington Times, of space war and what we should be doing by way of a space corps or other steps to ensure that we are indeed prepared for that eventuality.
Again, great question, Frank, and it's very similar to our evolution in thought about nuclear weapons and the integration of nuclear weapons in war plans. You recall that all nuclear weapons used to be owned by the Atomic Energy Commission, and it wasn't until much later that they were actually transferred custodial-wise to the military forces. Same as with space. We start with NASA. You know, we want to prevent the militarization of space, and therefore NASA becomes the focus. But then as time passes, we realize, perhaps belatedly, we realize that space is a place just like the land, just like the sea, just like the air. And other nations plan to wage war in space. The Russians and the Chinese have never regarded space as some immune place from military strategies and operations and capabilities. They've always regarded it as an internal place. The second point is that we're very vulnerable in space because a lot of our space assets in space are extremely vulnerable to all kinds of attack and electromagnetic pulse and all kinds of things.
Lasers and actual physical assault from the ground or from other satellites, for that matter.
Exactly. Yeah. And the Chinese are perfecting an ASAT capability that's all in the operational stage now. But so do we need a space command? Sure. Do we need a combatant command for space? Sure. Do we need the military services to sit down and to relitigate roles and missions like they did after World War II? Sure, we need all of that. And I think Trump has started out the right way by saying, okay, I want a separate service to train, equip, and budget for all this military space operations. And again, politics is everything, as you know, Frank. The military services resist this just like they resisted Goldwater Nichols. They don't want combatant commands. They didn't want combatant commands. They wanted to stay, keep the budgets and the big money in the component services. So it's basically a new iteration of a very, very old discussion here in town, and hopefully cooler heads will prevail. I understand, however, that the Hill is sort of moderating its view. Imhoff, for example, on the SASC was opposed, but now he is more amenable to a combatant command for space, which is a good start. But as you know, and I know, if you create a separate military service for space, Congress has to authorize it by statute. The president can't direct that on his own. I would just say stay tuned. My prediction is that there is a combatant command for space created first. The separate service to train and equip for space probably lags behind that.
Well, and I think your idea of a new Key West agreement that would facilitate clarification of roles and missions as they are evolving is also a very good idea. Dan Gallington, you're full of good ideas. It's always great to have a chance to explore them with you, and we'll look forward to doing so again in the near future. We'll look forward to talking to the rest of you again tomorrow, same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
Been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.